I want to talk about George W. Bush. George W. Bush has had a very good year over the last year. One might even say that the war on terrorism has been very good to him. His popularity rating, as people probably know, is still standing at really an astronomical, an astonishing 85%, which is really not bad for a president who didn't even win the popular vote in the election. And now Bush, who in the past has had, you know, as we know, has had difficulty with even pronouncing phrases such as nuclear proliferation. Now Bush has his own doctrine, the so-called Bush Doctrine, which is just that, nuclear proliferation. His doctrine, if you want to call it that, is best summarized by a headline that was run in the London Daily Mirror a few weeks ago with a picture of Bush saying, and the caption saying, "Let's nuke them all." And this, and I believe this is a very terrifying thought actually, is probably sums up the full extent of George Bush's thinking on the subject. The war in Afghanistan was used by Bush as the launching pad for this nuclear madness, with the news media giving Bush free rein to define the war in Afghanistan as a fight for justice, as a clash, as we know, between good and evil, between the civilized world and terrorism. The Bush administration gained a great deal of support for the war in Afghanistan based on the claim to be fighting to free Afghan women from oppression, as Anna pointed out. Thanks to U.S. bombs, Bush said in his State of the Union address, for those of us who could stomach sitting through it, we may remember this, he said, "Today women are free and are part of Afghanistan's new government." So far, however, not a single penny of the money that the United States promised to Afghan women's programs, including girls' education, has actually materialized, it's worth pointing out. The Bush administration is also well aware that the new Afghanistan is barely distinguishable from the Taliban-run Afghanistan. Bush knows because the Bush administration installed the new government and controls it. The interim government has already made clear, for example, that harsh sentencing laws are going to remain in effect throughout Afghanistan, laws that are barely distinguishable from those of the Taliban. Judge Amatullah Zarif recently announced, for example, that adulterers, both men and women, will continue to be stoned to death. He says, but we will only use small stones from now on. That's a quote. Public executions and amputations will continue, he said, but with more civility. For example, this is a quote from him, "The Taliban used to hang the victim's body in public for 4 days. We will only hang the body for a short time, say 15 minutes. This is his words. The New York Times also reported this week that the so-called, people may remember, Bush made a big deal out of it, the so-called religious police, the Department for the Promotion of Virtue and Prevention of Vice, you know, the religious police that used to go around beating up women who didn't adhere to the harsh laws under the Taliban, well, that's actually been reinstated now in Western Afghanistan, in Herat. And even though Bush publicly declared, as he did again in his State of the Union address, that American bombs have, quote, "saved a people from starvation," he knows better. Bush and Rumsfeld are well aware that U.S. bombs killed thousands of Afghan civilians, although they have yet to publicly admit anything close to the full extent of the civilian casualties. If past practice is any indication, it will be months or years after the war is over before that information becomes public. The U.S. government is also well aware that their much publicized air food drops, people remember that were supposed to give the, you know, humanitarian gloss to the bombing last fall, those food drops actually fed less than 1% of the 7 million Afghans that were at risk for starvation. It has now officially been established that the food that was dropped from airplanes flying flying at such high altitudes that most of the food was actually destroyed before it ever touched the ground. Oftentimes, the food packets were dropped in fields covered with landmines, and the food packets they were dropping, as it turned out, were yellow, the same color and just about the same size as the yellow cluster bomb canisters that they were also dropping from U.S. planes over Afghanistan so that starving Afghan people could easily mistake an unexploded cluster bomb for a food packet. It is no secret either that people are still starving in Afghanistan today. Some food aid organizations have estimated that up to 1 million Afghan people are going to starve by the time summer arrives. Because the warlords that the U.S. put back in control of Afghanistan are looting and shooting at the food aid trucks and preventing the food from getting to the people that need it most, especially in the remote areas. At the Maslak refugee camp, for example, which is about 30 miles west of Herat, again, just one small example, 100 refugees die every day from exposure and starvation. That means that in a single refugee camp, every single month, 3,000 people die, the same number that died on September 11th. The kind of suffering that is taking place would turn the stomachs of the vast majority of people in the United States if only they knew the truth of what is taking place, of what their tax dollars are being used for, of the atrocities that are being committed in our name. It would also make Bush's charges about the next U.S. target in its war, Iraq, about Saddam Hussein's so-called weapons of mass destruction sound pretty empty if it was made public to what extent the United States has inflicted death and destruction on the rest of the world, not to mention the hundreds of thousands of Iraqis that have already been killed by the U.S. sanctions and the many thousands more who will die if the U.S. invades Iraq once again. In fact, it's been estimated that if they shoot one single mini nuke aimed at one of Saddam Hussein's palaces, that mini nuke will kill 20,000 Iraqi people in one fell swoop if Bush makes good on his threat to use them against Iraq. Now, knowing the truth would also help people in this country, I believe, the vast majority of whom do continue to support the war, to understand why it is, in fact, that the U.S. government is so unpopular in the rest of the world. When millions of Americans have sought an answer to the question, why do they hate us so much since September 11th? And that is a reasonable question to ask, and one that an honest answer would actually help people to understand how the U.S. itself perpetuates terrorism. Instead, what are we given? TV viewers are given straight-faced reporting of George Bush giving this answer. Like most Americans, I just cannot believe it because I know how good we are. Now, most of the rest of the world doesn't see it quite like George Bush, with good reason. The United States is the world's richest country in a world in which more than 2 billion people live on less than $2 a day. That's one in every three people on Earth living in extreme poverty. Half the people in the world have never used a telephone, a striking fact. Now, everybody knows that 3,000 people died on September 11th. And share the pain of that atrocity. But how many people know that more than 10 times that number of children worldwide also died on September 11th of hunger, and that 35,000 children starve to death every single day around the world? And the U.S. is not the richest country just because of some lucky coincidence. U.S. military dominance is the means by which it maintains its economic dominance at the expense of the world's poor. A 1998 report from the United Nations, for example, estimated that the annual additional cost to provide basic human needs, food, clothing, and clean water to the world's population adds up to $40 billion. And that would seem like a small price to pay to end needless human suffering the world over. That amount seems even a smaller investment when you compare it with the $1 billion a day that the U.S. has spent for decades on the military, including $5 trillion on nuclear weapons alone since World War II. Now, going to war, claiming to feed the hungry and end suffering while doing the opposite is not unique to Afghanistan. It is a long-standing tradition of U.S. imperialism. One other recent example is that of Operation Restore Hope, another altruistic-sounding mission in Somalia in 1992, when the U.S. military went into Somalia ostensibly to feed starving Somali people and instead left behind 7,000 to 10,000 Somali dead bodies. Back in 1920, the left-wing journalist John Reed commented on the U.S. role in a different war, This one after the slaughter of Armenians by Turkey, but his words could just as well apply to today's Afghanistan. He said, and I quote, "The American capitalists promised bread to Armenia. This is an old trick. They promise bread but never give it. Did Hungary get bread after the fall of the Soviet government? No. The Hungarian people are still starving today. Did the Baltic countries get bread? No, comrades. Uncle Sam never gives anybody something for nothing. He comes along with a sack stuffed with hay in one hand and a whip in the other. Anyone who accepts Uncle Sam's promises at their face value will find that they must be paid for in sweat and blood." And today, I would argue that this is just as true. Through its war on Afghanistan, the U.S. established permanent military bases in the following places: Afghanistan, Pakistan, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, and Tajikistan, with facilities in Kazakhstan. That corresponds exactly to the route of a planned American oil pipeline from the Caspian Sea oil basin. Look at the next target, Iraq. The overthrow of Saddam Hussein will give the U.S. control over Iraq's vast oil reserves, which are second only to those of Saudi Arabia in the world. Now, these simple facts, in my opinion, shed much more light on the real purpose of the war on terrorism than the statements of self-righteous indignation emanating from George W. Bush. War is the means by which the world's rich and powerful keep themselves rich and powerful at the expense of the vast majority of the world's population. And by the way, that is true inside as well as outside the United States. The U.S. holds the distinction not only of being the world's richest country, but of being the most unequal country among advanced industrial societies. That is, with the biggest gap between rich and poor. And that is why inside the United States today, after the longest economic boom in history in the 1990s, still today, almost one in every three workers in this country is earning poverty-level wages. 30 million people, and 12 million of them are children, do not get enough to eat on a regular basis. And millions upon millions of people, as we well know, are dangling just a paycheck or two away from poverty or from homelessness. And the fact that the U.S. has such a huge gap between the rich and poor has everything to do with the fact that the U.S. is also one of the most repressive societies in the world. The so-called land of the free has the largest proportion of its citizens behind bars and is one of the few industrialized nations to continue to practice the barbaric death penalty to scare and, yes, terrorize its own population into submission. And the massive increase in repression of the U.S. military internationally and the racism that has accompanied the war on terrorism has its parallel police repression and the racism that accompanies it at home, which Anna Mustafa spoke of so eloquently. Most people are vaguely aware of the massive roundup and detention of Arabs and Muslims since September 11th, but few people are aware of how broad the crackdown goes. The U.S. mass media, with all its investigative capabilities, has made no effort to trace the stories of the 2,000 Arabs and Muslims who have been rounded up and detained since September 11th, more than 300 of whom, like Rabia Haddad, being held in Chicago, are still being held without any charges of terrorism being filed against them. Nor has the media covered the growing list of other victims of the crackdown. Just one small example of what is taking place all over. In February, 30 African Americans of Somali descent, all of whom have lived in this country since they were babies or small children, were rounded up without being charged with anything. They were beaten and threatened with injections and refused phone calls or access to lawyers. They were then put on a plane and deported to Mogadishu, Somalia, where they have been left sitting in a squalid hotel without passports, papers, or money, and with no contact with their families inside the U.S. This is the kind of news that never seems to make its way to the mainstream media. Excuse me. Now, I want to end by saying it is true. George Bush is riding high right now, and that situation is not going to change overnight. But I guarantee you it is going to change. The very success of the war on terrorism is going to come back to haunt him as this war continues, And as the targets get further and further away from any possible connection to September 11th, from Iraq to Iran to Colombia to North Korea, as the U.S. also claims to be fighting for justice and then supports Israel while it engages in the mass slaughter of Palestinians who have been unjustly denied the right to citizenship in the home of their Palestinian ancestors, many more people are going to realize that they were lied to from the very beginning. This war never had anything to do with winning justice for the victims of September 11th. September 11th was just a convenient excuse for the U.S. military to go on the rampage all over the world for no other reason than to expand its own domination in a world that it already dominates. Change is not going to happen overnight, but it is going to happen. And those of us, like people in this room, who already know the truth about this war, we have a role to play in making that happen by building an opposition to this war, an opposition that says, yeah, if you want to put a stop to terrorism, start at the top of the food chain, not at the bottom. Many of the same people that are now giving Bush his high approval ratings are going to remember at some point not only that they didn't vote for him, but that George Bush stole the election by disenfranchising thousands of Black Florida voters. People are going to realize not only that the war on terrorism doesn't benefit working class people in this country, but that Bush expects us to pay for it by cuts in education, cuts in health care, job cuts, and cutting our freedom of speech, and of course, ever more tax cuts for the already wealthy. That is the kind of movement, when it happens, that will have the opportunity to put George Bush and his Dr. Strangelove routine right where they belong, into the dustbin of history. Read our lips, George Bush. Another world is possible.